Well, so Dirty Harry says to this crooked cop who threatens to bring him down, well, he says it in the direction of that crooked cop because his car blows up, but he says several lines that several of you have used with me on several occasions, a man's got to know his limitations. And that's what our passage deals with today. Part of being wise is to know the limitations of wisdom, really to know the limitations of your wisdom. So we're starting the second half of the book today, and really that's the second half of a sermon. So Ecclesiastes is Greek for the Hebrew Kohelet, which again means the preacher or the assembler or the convener. What I've encouraged us to say is it's Solomon coming off his throne. I think it's Solomon writing and styling himself the preacher to be the wise disciple or shepherd as someone who knows he's a mess but has learned a lot and wants to encourage us and exhort us in a more life-giving path than he spent much of his life in. So we're starting the second half of the book, and the first half dealt with the meaning of life, primarily. The meaning of life here under the sun, and it's been real life. Under the sun is real life. It's what everybody really deals with. His point is to take the rose-colored glasses off of ourselves, to quit pretending, to quit thinking it's different than it is, to face the bewildering and burdensome aspect of this world under the sun, you know, confusing and even crushing at times. The reality of death is present. You know, every week in our little circles and around the world, something is happening. Something unsettling. He's making us look at that, pulling back the curtain. He's helping us where to find meaning under the sun and saying in various ways, like you can't find it in what you see, do, and feel, if that's all you're going for. That you have to go above the sun and beyond the grave. You can't limit yourself to under the sun. It's a cry for that. It's pointing us that way. But once you go above the sun and beyond the grave, once you meet God and rest in Him and know He is who you need and want, then you go back under the sun and you find meaning in what you do and see and feel. And so, what is that meaning we find up to this point? Meaning in life is found very simply in the sacred ordinary. Live your life as a gift of God's grace to you. Travel up the gift to the giver. Fear God. Enjoy the blessings He's given you. And tend your little gardens. Once that is established, now we enter the second half of the sermon, and the preacher's tone we're going to see today, it shifts. And he speaks in a lot of Proverbs. And the second half of the book of Ecclesiastes, he focuses on advising us, okay, given that that's meaning in life, how do you live wisely in this broken world? How then shall we live in this broken world? And so we start that today. So let's read chapter 7. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It is better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fools. This also is vanity. Surely oppression drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the heart of fools. Say not, why were the former days better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask this. Wisdom is good, with an inheritance and advantage to those who see the sun. For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money, and the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. Consider the work of God, who can make straight what he has made crooked. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. In the day of adversity, consider God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. In my vain life, I have seen everything. There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in his evil doing. Be not overly righteous, and do not make yourself too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Be not overly wicked, neither be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you should take hold of this, and from that withhold not your hand. For the one who fears God shall come out from both of them. Wisdom gives strength to the wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. Surely there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. Do not take to heart all the things that people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. Your heart knows that many times you yourself have cursed others. All this I have tested by wisdom. I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. That which has been is far off and deep, very deep. Who can find it out? I turned my heart to know and to search out and to seek wisdom in the scheme of things and to know the wickedness of folly and the foolishness that is madness. And I found something more bitter than death, the woman whose heart is snares and nets and whose hands are fetters. He who pleases God escapes her, but the sinner is taken by her. Behold, this is what I found, says the preacher, while adding one thing to another to find the scheme of things, which my soul has sought repeatedly, but I have not found. One man among 1,000 I found, but a woman among all these I have not found. See, this alone I have found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. Grass withers and the flowers fade. And this good word, which has gospel underneath it, endures forever, even to today. Amen. So I have two main points with a bunch of points underneath them. So get ready. The first point is the leverage of wisdom. The second point is the limitation of wisdom. So the leverage of wisdom is verses 1. I made a change. Let's see. It's verses 1. Yeah. So the leverage of wisdom is verse 1 through 12. And the limitations is 13 through 29. Leverage meaning the benefit or the advantage. The idea of the leverage of wisdom is, how do we live in the fear of the Lord? What are some practical uses and advantages of cultivating wisdom? So first, wisdom looks like in this broken world to be sober-minded. And that's verses 1 to 4. So in verses 1, living in wisdom, living in the fear of the Lord here under the sun means knowing a good name is better than precious ointment. So do you know that a good name is better than precious ointment? In that arid climate, you know, Israelites valued fine oils as a luxury item. It was a big deal. But wisdom says your good name, meaning your reputation, is more valuable than that. It's more pleasing than that. So we take that to today in our world that prizes glamour and glitz. We could imagine that as a rich fragrance that fills the room. That we should not get down on ourselves if we feel overlooked or unappreciated. Remember that wisdom says cultivating your character, things like joy and integrity, compassion, generosity, are much greater treasures than that. And of course, we look at this and we see the rest of the story. Recall that Ecclesiastes gives us the question for which the rest of the Bible gives the answer. We look at that and we can't help but think the rest of the story tells us about one who would come, whose name is above every name. And for that reason, we refuge ourselves in him and his reputation before the throne of God. Well, the first part of the proverb leads to the second. And it's a surprise. It's meant to get your attention, catch you off guard, to make you stop and think. We breeze through things very easily. So from that one, it's related to the next one. And the day of death is better than the day of birth. And we stop and we pause. We say, how on earth is that the case? We know also that the preacher is not some dour, morose guy who's just through with life. I mean, he's advised us, eat, drink, enjoy your family and friends. He's not Eeyore. He doesn't have a death wish. So why is the day of death better in his counsel than the day of birth? I mean, hardly anything is more joyous than the birth of a little bouncy baby. Hardly anything is more heartbreaking than the death of a loved one. So one way to view it is that it's at the end of a person's life that you know about her character, what she's known for, what she lived for. You don't know that at her birth. They finished the race, Zach Eswine. It is the obituary, not the birth announcement, that best reveals the measure of a person. In that sense, it's better. Or in the other sense, it's better is that the death of a loved one speaks to us about our own futures. The commentator Ian Provan says, death is an evangelist. Death looks at us in the eyes and says, prepare for me now. Prepare to stand before God. And that's why the preacher says in the next verse that it's better to visit a grieving person's house than to go to a house party. Again, he loves parties. He loves feasts. But he says, this is better for you. It's better in that sense to be sorrowful than to be lighthearted with laughter. It's beneficial to sympathize with a family who's lost a loved one, to sit there if you lay it to heart. With this reality, the question that comes to mind is, how should I live in light of my own approaching death? The rest of the story, however, it cries out for more. The rest of the story says, we have a king, the greater Solomon, who conquered death. Second, counsel of living wisely in a broken world, verses 5-6, be teachable always, 5-6. So it's better for a man to hear a wise man rebuke him than to laugh and sing with his drinking buddies at a party. But then we ask, which is more fun? What do I want to do? Well, I want to be at the party. Who doesn't love a party? It feels much better. We prefer to be distracted and to be entertained and to escape. Maybe more so in our day and age than in any age, because we have so many options for that. We carry one around with us all the time. But the thoughtful, examined life, he's saying, is better. Solitude is better. Having a wise friend that would come around you and love you so much as to confront your pitfalls and help you prioritize is better. So be humble and teachable and put yourself in those kinds of relationships. The party is like a flashy, brief flame. If you put thorn bushes that are dry in the fire, they crackle, they make noise, they make a flashy fire, but there's no heat and it's brief. That's a party, but real gospel conversation warms our hearts, creates real heat, real love for Christ and love for others. Third, be just. Be just, verse 7. And so the word there in verse 7 in the ESV, oppression, can also be translated extortion. With the next line, bribe corrupts the heart, we have money issues again. And it's a warning. And the warning is that even a wise man, even a wise woman, can get knocked off kilter by money. And in this case, it's extortion and bribery. It's buying someone or being bought. Something else has taken root in the heart, manifested through these transactions, whether it's power or security or money itself, has occupied the throne of the heart to where this wise man, before he knows it, his judgment is clouded and he's lost control and he's in danger. And so underneath this, Solomon, or the preacher, is counseling us, watch out for that. You need to be just. You need to do the right thing. You need to have the right means to the right ends. You need to take care of weak people. You need to help others flourish. That's what it's about here. Fourth, verse 8 to 10, be patient. Be patient. So wisdom is patient and persevering. In verse 8, the preacher says, better is the end of a thing than its beginning. Now, you could spend some time on that phrase. It's a wise caution. It's one thing to start something, another finish it. It's one thing, you know, to have an idea. It's another thing to follow through on that idea when it gets tough. Have you ever gotten stuck in a project and you just chunked it instead of sticking it out? Better is the end than the beginning. Or popular in our day to say, it's all about the journey. Not so much the destination, but here he's saying, well, the conclusion is important. The destination is important. Think about a relationship. When a relationship gets hard, better the end than the beginning. Think about parenthood. Better the end than the beginning. Stick it out. Be patient. And he supports that by saying, better is length of spirit than height of spirit. That's the literal translation. Which you could say, better the long game of patience than the inflated, puffed up view of yourself that is pride. The verse 9 warns against how this pride would manifest itself in anger. So patience would guard against it. Pride would fuel it. Patience would say, yeah, this is a fallen world. Things are tough. I'm just gotta keep it in the road. But pride would fly off the handle and say, forget it, I'm done, I'm out of here. Verse 10 continues this idea. Say not, why were the former days better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask that. If us have not said, man, it was better when I was a kid. Or those are the good old days. The world is going from bad to worse today. That nostalgia for the good old days, he's saying, is a form of impatience, really dissatisfaction. It's missing the good of the present and forgetting the evil of the past. It's losing sight of the fact that right now God is at work. Like he's working right now. C.S. Lewis adds to this when he says, look, nostalgia isn't so much a longing for the past as it's a longing for the future. The way our memories work, we've glorified something in the past because that thing in the past, in our memory, triggers a hunger and longing for glory itself. Embrace it and move forward to the new heavens and the new earth. Something like Ecclesiastes 3, eternity is in your heart, and that's what you want. Fifth, be a good steward, verse 11 through 12. So in verse 11, the preacher says that wisdom is a helpful companion to an inheritance. Makes sense. It helps you preserve it and not dissipate it or fritter it away. That is a good reason it's a benefit to a person under the sun. In fact, in verse 12, he adds that wisdom and money are similar in that both provide protection in life. Literally, it's provide shadow or shade from the heat. So it's not the highest praise. There's higher praises in Scripture. But it is true. Johnny Carson, you know, as rich as he was, he said this about money. The one thing good about money is that money keeps you from worrying about money. There's a value in it. It takes some worries off, protects you from hunger and exposure and bill payments. In a similar way, wisdom protects you from making dumb decisions. So verse 12, wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. And so the combination is what's most valuable. And so underneath this, I see that he's counseling us to be a good steward. The fact that life is short doesn't mean that our stuff doesn't matter. Wisdom about stewarding your wealth well in view of the brevity of time. This is part of wisdom. That we are to make use of this wisdom to preserve our lives. But underneath that, you see, we long for the true wisdom who doesn't preserve our lives just under the sun, but above the sun and beyond the grave. Well, that's the leverage of wisdom. Good counsels, but always opening up the need for him who is true wisdom. Well, what about the limitations of wisdom? So a man's got to know his limitations. Wisdom under the sun has its limits. Well, the first thing as we think about the limits of wisdom are certain counsels for us. First, don't think you can fix everything because you can't. Verse 13 and 14, it's a shift. Wise men, and particularly in this day, wise men tended to think that by wisdom they could predict the future. That they could control outcomes, that they could fix what was broken. Their reading of Proverbs, for example, you know, Proverbs 3:5, trust in the Lord with all your heart, lean not on your own understanding in all your ways, acknowledge him and what? He will make your path straight. We pray that, we hold to it, we learn it, and yet what he's saying is, it's not just that if you put that input in, you're gonna get that output. There's more going on. The preacher says, you're giving yourself too much credit. This is important, but not the whole story. There are things that are wrong that won't get fixed, no matter how wise you are. He's preparing us for what happened to Job or similar things. In a fallen world, things bend and break, and that doesn't necessarily mean you didn't do it right. So take the burden off your shoulders. Consider the work of God. He's doing something. Give it to him. He's the one who has to fix it. You could see Romans 8 in this light. We're groaning, waiting for the redemption of our bodies, the resolution of all things. And so he counsels, celebrate the day of prosperity. Like, don't miss the opportunity to celebrate, to smile, to laugh, to thank him for even the small blessings that you receive. But then, the day of adversity, consider. Think it over. Don't run away from it. Don't explain it away. Stop, grieve it, learn from it, take it to heart that even in this adversity, God is working. He's working his purposes out in your life. And be comforted that if he's wrapped up in it, then he's also working it out for your good, and it won't be wasted. And he proves that in the gospel itself. The very worst event in all of history, the cross of Christ, is really the most beautiful thing in all of history. Second, along with this, don't be too hard on yourself. Verse 15 through 20. And I think you need to hear that. Don't be too hard on yourself. The preacher starts out by saying, under the sun, it's more complex than do the right thing and everything's going to work out. He says, I've seen a righteous man perish and a wicked man prosper. But then his assessment of that is kind of confusing for us. You got to settle down and think it through. He says, don't be overly righteous or don't seek too much wisdom. Now he's saying, what is he saying? Like, don't be righteous, don't be wise. And then he says, don't be overly wicked and don't be a fool. What is he saying? Be a little bit wicked? Is he counseling mediocrity and lukewarm Christianity? Is he counseling a via media, like just civil Christianity? And we, like, how does that relate to pursue holiness without which no one will receive the Lord? Well, verse 18, he elevates fearing God as the corrector to both. In verses 19 through 20, he clears it up a little bit more. Wisdom makes a man or a woman stronger than 10 political leaders, those who make the powerful decisions. Wisdom is stronger, so go after it. However, remember in verse 20, there is not a righteous man on earth who does good and never sins. All right, so what's he getting at with all this? I think what he's getting at is wisdom and righteousness are the goal. Go for these. But just remember, you're never going to attain them under the sun. So don't get too wound up and too bent out of shape when you don't do things perfectly. Don't sink under like a submerged guilt trip in your life, or don't live with the dread that the shoe's about to fall. Of course, wisdom and righteousness are the goal, but realize you won't fully arrive until you stand before God. It's Romans 5:20, when sin increased, grace increased all the more. Because we know the rest of the story, we can settle into this even better, because we know that Solomon's greater son, he did fully achieve the goal and did that on our behalf. Third, so don't be too hard on others. Verses 21 and 22. They go together. So if we aren't to be too hard on ourselves, then we also shouldn't be too hard on others. So the preacher uses the illustration of the tongue, but really that's just one sin pattern among others. It's just the tongue gets us all. I mean, James 3. So don't get angry, upset, and hold it over people when you hear they've said something mean or unfair or critical about you. I have no idea. Something really important. So it happened very early this morning, and I don't get angry or upset or hold it over people when they hear something critical, unfair about you. So the question is why here? And why is because you've done the exact same thing. The issue is that you rationalize it when you do it, but you absolutize it when they do it. So don't hold others to a higher standard than you hold yourself. Just like you explain away your faults, do so for them too. Don't be too hard on people. And fourth, don't expect to understand everything. Verses 23 and 24. Wisdom does not mean God lets us into the control room to give us the inside scoop on everything. Sometimes we can think we're supposed to have more insight than God said he's given us. It's so refreshing to hear what the preacher says. I thought it through, I considered it, and it was deep, very deep, too far from me. But what's the answer? I know God. I know God's purposes for me must be good. What was Paul's answer when he was trying to plumb the depths of God's sovereignty and salvation in Romans 11? Oh, the depths of the wisdom and the knowledge of God, how unsearchable his judgments and his past beyond tracing out. Who has known the mind of the Lord? Or who has been his counselor? Let me dwell on the nature and character of God. The one who devised the mystery of the gospel must do all things well. And lastly, fifth, don't give in to the current of the world. Your wisdom isn't going to rescue you under the sun from the schemes, the way of doing things in this world. But don't give in to it. The preacher says he's thought long and hard about life. He's contemplated the scheme of things. We could say the wisdom under the sun in James 3, as MD was saying. He's contemplated the scheme of these things, the way this fallen world operates. So the question for us is, have I really contemplated what seems so natural, just the way you do things here? In fact, this preacher, he plunged himself into everything the world had to offer, the wickedness and folly and the foolishness of madness, and he did so looking for meaning and purpose and came up empty. And that is to say and warn all of us, you don't have to go there with him. Young people, he's really discipling you and saying, look, I did it all, and I messed up a lot. Let me just save you the trouble. Well, one thing he found most bitter by experience is a certain kind of woman, the adulteress, who uses her body to get what she wants. And along with that, something very, very bitter was a certain kind of man, maybe himself, who's taken by her. That is, who has no higher aim in life that would guard him from being enslaved to her, to want to use her body to satisfy his void in his heart. And the idea is that they mutually damage each other. They live in lust and they don't learn how to love. It's the current of the world. How much of our world is occupied and obsessed with exactly this? That we can occupy our hearts, go from distraction to distraction in reality or virtually right here. Don't do that, he says. Then continuing to meditate on the scheme of this world, the preacher realizes he's only found one righteous man in 1,000 and no righteous woman in 1,000. And that's a shock to us. And it's meant to be. Why one man and no woman? Well, the main point is he's found one in 2,000. But maybe it's autobiographical. We could spend a lot of time on this, but maybe it's his own experience he's talking about. Solomon at least had Nathan the prophet, that wise man, to counsel him. He had one man in 1,000. But Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines, literally 1,000 women. And none of those women were the godly, pious women that he exalts in Proverbs or he'll speak about in Ecclesiastes 9. They turned his heart from the Lord. The main point is what he says in the last verse. This alone I have found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. And that's the root problem of it all, and that's why wisdom has its limitations. It's a reflection on Genesis 1 through 3. God created us with this noble creation in his very image, and yet we elected to embrace sin and the devil. Schemes is related to the word thoughts in Genesis 6:5, when God said, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually, and God sends the destruction of the flood. There's a strong current in the world, a way of doing things, to turn away from God and to live for ourselves. We want to be independent. It's talking about our depravity and sin. And the preacher's urging us to be mindful of this. Our wisdom helps us see it, but our wisdom can't solve it. And so there's an angst here. In fact, the preacher's admitting the problem isn't just out there, but it's in here. It's my wayward heart. It's the worldly scheme that's wrapped around my own affections. so we may want to fear God and keep his commandments, which is his final application in the sermon, but our hearts oppose it. We have a Romans 7 dynamic constantly. And that's reality in this fallen, broken world under the sun. Again, it cries out that we've got to go above the sun and beyond the grave to the rest of the story. You see, we desperately need that one man, not just in 1,000, but that one man in history, the God-man. We need the man that came and did it right. We need the greater Solomon to the highest degree, the one who lived the truly upright life, who did it with true wisdom and true righteousness. We need the one who lifted himself up on the cross to atone for our sins in full before the wrath and judgment of God. We need this one man and none other. It all cries out for him, the rest of the story. It's a lament for him, and it's a summons to us. Our wisdom is limited because we need him who is God's true wisdom. And so, do you have him today? Have you turned your heart to know and to search him? He's God's wisdom through the foolishness of the cross. You refuge yourself in him, and you become upright before the throne room of God. And you're safe and secure under the sun, all the way beyond the grave. And that's what the meaning of life is all about. May God add his blessing. Let's stand.